what I'm hoping is the final word on vaccines and autism.
Using low-dose aspirin after prostate cancer diagnosis.
Can wearable technologies help us avoid bad outcomes for people who've had surgery?
And a patient cured of HIV infection.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on March 15th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also the dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think that we should start first with the HIV remission in the treatment of this one man who was HIV positive. That was in Nature.
It's interesting because it was about a decade ago that there was a reported case of an individual cured. This individual lived in Berlin, and it's referred to as the Berlin patient. And so this is the second such report. And it's an individual that had confirmed HIV and as a result of therapy developed lymphoma, which is not terribly uncommon. And the person underwent different types of chemotherapy for the lymphoma, but it was unsuccessful in causing it to have remission. So he underwent a bone marrow transplant. Now, it's interesting because the bone marrow he received had cells in it that were deficient for a receptor that the HIV infection could bind to. So as a result, this person repopulated his bone marrow with the cells from the bone marrow transplant. The HIV virus could not bind to it. And over the course of 18 months, the person has no reported HIV infection.
So these are really great proofs of concept in my mind, but having borne witness to the consequences of bone marrow transplantation, it's hard for me to imagine, given the really great medicines that we have right now to render HIV infection a chronic disease that doesn't really impact too much on somebody's lifespan or on a lot of what's going on, that this would actually be something we would want to undertake.
So Elizabeth, your point's very well taken. I mean, it has serious consequences associated with bone marrow transplant, side effects as well. It's very costly, prolonged hospitalization. But what it does do is it shows that this particular receptor that was missing in the bone marrow donor, that's called the CCR5 receptor, plays an important role. And perhaps there are other ways we can use this knowledge to cure HIV in the future, perhaps doing genetic changes in the same receptor that do not require a bone marrow transplant.
That would absolutely be a better outcome. Let's turn from here in Annals of Internal Medicine to what I served up as, wow, I really hope this is the last word with regard to autism spectrum disorders and vaccines. That old thing that just that skeleton that keeps emerging from the closet or whatever we want to call it. It's just we've got to put this thing to rest. And I really think this study might be the way to do it. I hardly ever cite the exact numbers, but in this case, it was 657,461 Danish children who were born in 1999, and they followed them through August 2013. During that time, 6,517, which is so crazy that that percentage, were diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders. And they said, was there a relationship between vaccination with MMR and the development of autism spectrum disorders? And the answer was absolutely a resounding no. There was no relationship. And even among groups that were at risk, so kids who had a family history and they already had a sibling who had an autism spectrum disorder, even among that group, there was no increased risk. I'm convinced. How about you?
You're absolutely right. This should be the end of this story. And for a number of reasons. I'll remind our listeners that it was over two decades ago that the controversial paper was published in Lancet suggesting there might be a correlation between the mumps, measles, and rubella vaccination and autism. And that paper was retracted because it was scientifically wrong. Well, this is the largest study done to date. This same group, by the way, did a study on over 300,000 Danish kids previously. As you said, this is over 657,000 kids. And it puts to rest the issue of people said, well, it may not cause autism in all kids, but those that are susceptible, those are the kids it does. Well, this shows that it does not. And then the other thing is they said, well, it depends on when you receive it. If you receive it at a young age versus an old age, well, this says it doesn't matter what age you receive it. There's no association with autism. So I agree with you, Elizabeth. The MMR vaccination has no correlation with autism. And this is the final word in this very big study.
And in view of the fact that we are witnessing measles outbreaks all over the world in countries where the vaccine is freely available, I think that this is compelling evidence that there ought to be actually legislation that says you must vaccinate your child if they're going to be in a public place.
And in fact, Elizabeth, it was in 2000 where they thought measles was eradicated from the United States. But because individuals have not been vaccinated recently, we've had outbreaks over the last several years, and at least five this year already, with several hundred people in the United States developing measles.
And not a benign disease. It has sequela.
And leading all the way up to death.
Let's remain in animals, and let's turn to your second one. That's prostate cancer. Does low-dose aspirin do any good whatsoever?
There was some suggestion that regular aspirin use would improve prostate cancer survival. And the reason for that is aspirin has several properties that could be considered beneficial. It causes death of cells, it's anti-inflammatory, and in some suggested studies, it prevented metastasis of prostate cancer. But what these investigators ask is there an association between the post-diagnosis use of low-dose aspirin and prostate cancer mortality? So these are men that have known prostate cancer, some of whom take low-dose aspirin, some of whom who don't. And does aspirin improve the mortality? So this is over 29,000 men, average age or median age 70 years. They were followed up for a median of 5 years. And what they discovered was that the post-diagnosis use of low-dose aspirin was not associated with an improvement in mortality. That is disappointing.
Yeah, it is disappointing. I know we keep struggling to try to see something that's going to prolong survival and have some help in that disease.
And again, the virtue of this study was, although it was a nationwide cohort study from Denmark, it was a large number of individuals. So I think the study is a fairly robust study.
Let's turn finally to JAMA Network Open. This, I thought, was a rather provocative study, a small study, where they took 100 patients who were having 8 different operations between July 2016 and August 2017 at Cedars-Sinai. The mean age of these patients was 53. Their 53% of them were also women. And their mean length of stay in the hospital was 4 days. They used a wearable device to take a look at the number of steps that these folks took postoperatively. And their physicians had written a script saying, hey, I'd like you to get up and start moving around. And they basically found that a higher step count on postoperative day number one was associated with decreased odds of a prolonged length of stay to 1,000 steps. So if the patient took 1,000 steps, up to 1,000 steps, then there was this linear relationship of benefit. And then it plateaued and there was no further benefit after that. So basically, they were able to use this technology and identify patients who might be at risk for poor outcomes or a prolonged length of stay after an operation. I'm encouraged by this study. I think it's part of the incremental movement toward the use of these wearable technologies that might actually result in some benefit.
And Elizabeth, the nice thing about this particular study, again, it was a wearable technology. It uses a supercomputer, i.e. a smartphone, to document how many steps they're taking. And the physician typically writes an order that says something like this, ambulate with assistance. And when they looked at the patients, some of them ambulated 0 steps, and some ambulated up to 7,600 steps. And with that, they were able to document that if they ambulated more than 1,000 steps, it decreased their length of stay. They recovered faster. They had fewer complications. And by the way, the physician did a poor job of estimating how much the patient was ambulating based upon what the wearable monitor showed. So the physician would say, oh yeah, I know the patient's getting up and getting out of bed. Well, the answer was they weren't necessarily very good at predicting that. So this is the nice use of a very minimally expensive technology that's readily available that gives quantitative data that's much better than the physician guessing what's going on.
Yeah. And what I'd like to see is further analysis of, let's take a look at postoperative steps and preoperative condition and see what that looks like. And then also look at their comorbidities and see how they correlate with their ability to actually get up and ambulate following an operation. I'd also like to see, post-discharge, a longer-term follow-up on do steps predict readmissions, for example.
For example, you could use this technology before the operation to figure out how often the patient's ambulating. So the patient can tell you, oh, yeah, I'm really active. And when you look at their wearable monitor, you realize, listen, you may think you are, but you don't walk very much. And if you did that, it would make your operation safer. So your point's well taken.
Yeah, I think one of these days, unfortunately or fortunately, we're going to have Big Brother leaning over our shoulders all the time looking at those kinds of things. So on that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.